His rich and riotous energy was the source of his genius and his faults. It brought him the depth and passion of his plays, and it brought him twins and an early death. He could not even go home to Stratford without doing mischief on the way, for always he stopped at Mrs. Davenant's Inn at Oxford. Streatford and Oxford were fording places on the stagecoach route to Ireland. And finally left behind him there a young William Davenant, who became a minor poet and never complained of his paternity. Once the boy was running to the inn when a wit stopped him with a query whither he was bound. Quote, "To see my godfather, William Shakespeare," close quote, replied the lad. "My boy," said the wit, "do not take God's name in vain." Invited to present plays at court, he basked for a time in the sunshine of fair ladies and brave men, and fell madly in love with Mary Fitton, or some other dark lady of some other name. Dame Quickly and Doll Tearsheet disappeared from his plays, and stately Portia entered. His soul bubbled over with romance and comedy, and his spirit frolicked in creating Viola and Rosalind and Ariel. But love is never quite content. In its secret heart is a poisonous anxiety, a premonition of alienation and decay. "Love," says Rosalind, "is merely a madness, and I tell you deserves a dark house and a whip as madmen do." "By heaven," says Byron, "I do love, and it hath taught me melancholy." For this was the heart of Shakespeare's tragedy, and the nadir of his life, that his dearest friend, W.H., to whom he had addressed sonnets of limitless love, came now and stole from him the dark lady of his new passion. He raged, and added to the sonnet's songs of madness and doubt. He sank into a hell of suffering, gnawed his heart out with brooding grief, and laid it bare for all to see in Hamlet, Othello, Macbeth, Timon, and Lear. But his torture deepened him. Now he passed from easy comedies and simple characters to complex personalities moving through intricate tragedies to black, inevitable destinies. He became, through despair, the greatest poet of all. What we like in him most is the madness and richness of his speech. His style is as his life was, full of energy, riot, color, and excess. Nothing succeeds like excess. It is all hurried and breathless, this style. Shakespeare wrote in haste and never found leisure to repent. He never erased a line or read a proof. The notion that his plays would someday be read rather than performed did not enter his head. Thoughtless of the future, he wrote with unrestrained passion. Words, images, phrases, and ideas rush from him in an inexhaustible and astounding flood. One wonders from what turbulent springs they pour. He has, quote, "a mint of phrases in his brain," close quote, and his fine frenzy is of imagination all compact. No man had ever mastered language, or used it with such lordly abandon. Anglo-Saxon words, French words, Latin words, alehouse words, medical words, legal words, tripping monosyllabic lines, and sonorous sesquipedalian speech, pretty ladylike euphemisms and rough idiomatic obscenities. Only an Elizabethan could have dared to write such English. We have better manners now and less power. Yes, the plots are impossible, as Tolstoy said. The puns are puerile, the errors of scholarship are un-Baconianly legion, and the philosophy is one of surrender and despair. It does not matter. What matters is that on every page is a godlike energy of soul, and for that we will forgive a man anything. Life is beyond criticism, and Shakespeare is more alive than life. Number 8. John Keats. Let us pause for a moment and count the great whom we have passed by unsung. First Sappho, flinging her lyric love from a Lesbian promontory. Then Aeschylus and Sophocles, winning the Dionysian prize so many times oftener than Euripides. Subtle Catullus, courtly Horace, lively Ovid, and mellifluous Virgil. Petrarch and Tasso, Omar Fitzgerald, Chaucer and Villon. But this is small offense by the side of the sins we must yet commit. Even Milton and Goethe are to be called, but not chosen. Even Blake and Burns, Byron and Tennyson, Hugo and Verlaine, Heine and Poe. Heine, the imp of verse, and Poe, the better half of poetry. To leave them out seems unforgivable. Tennyson, whose every song was beautiful, and Byron, whose very life was a lyric tragedy, who are the greater ones for whom these must make way? Worse yet, not to take Milton in, who wrote like princes, potentates, and powers, and made English to thunder and blare like the Hebrew of Isaiah. Worst of all, to leave Goethe aside, the very soul of Germany, who wrote in his youth like Heine, in his maturity like Euripides, and in his old age like a Gothic cathedral, confused and endlessly surprising. What good German, or good European, will put up with this? Never mind. Let us sin bravely and name not the philosopher Goethe, but the poet John Keats. Stricken down with consumption in 1819, Keats, after weeks in bed, wrote to Fanny Braun, quote, "Now I have had opportunities of passing nights anxious and awake. I have found thoughts obtrude upon me. If I should die, I said to myself, I have left no immortal work behind me, nothing to make my friends proud of my memory. But I have loved the principle of beauty in all things, and if I had had time, I would have made myself remembered." Close quote. If I had had time, this is the tragedy of all great men. Keats never wrote anything of importance after that. Nevertheless, his friends are remembered because of him, and he has left behind him poems as immortal as English, and more perfect than Shakespeare. We shall say no more about him, but refresh ourselves with himself. He sings to the nightingale. Darkling, I listen, and for many a time I have been half in love with easeful death. Called him soft names in many a mused rhyme. To take into the air my quiet breath, now more than ever seems it rich to die. To cease upon the midnight with no pain, while thou art pouring forth thy soul abroad in such an ecstasy. Still wouldst thou sing, and I have ears in vain, to thy high requiem become a sod. And this to melancholy. She dwells with beauty, beauty that must die, and joy, whose hand is ever at his lips, bidding adieu, and aching pleasure nigh. Turning to poison while the bee mouth sips, I, in the very temple of delight, veiled melancholy was her sovereign shrine. Though seen of none save him whose strenuous tongue can burst joy's grape against his palate fine, his soul shall taste the sadness of her might, and be among her cloudy trophies hung. He went from England to Italy, seeking the sun, but the storms of the sea racked his body, and the dust of the south did him no good. Time and again he spit up cupfuls of blood. He asked that letters from Fanny Braun be kept from him. He could not bear to read them. He ceased to write to her or his friends. He had only to die. He tried to swallow poison, but Severn took it away from him. "The idea of death," said Severn, "seems his only comfort. He talks of it with delight. The thought of recovery is beyond everything dreadful to him." In the final days, his mind grew to great quietness and peace. He dictated his epitaph, "Here lies one whose name is writ in water." Repeatedly, he asked the doctor, "When will this posthumous life of mine come to an end?" As the last struggle came, he said, "Severn, lift me up, for I am dying. I shall die easy. Don't be frightened. Thank God it has come." It was February 23rd, 1821, and he was 25 years old. If I had had time. Number 9. Percy Bysshe Shelley. When Shelley heard that Keats had died by tubercle bacilli and the Quarterly Review, he sank into a long seclusion and poured his wrath and grief into the greatest of English elegies, Adonais. He must have felt, with his feminine sensitivity to every wind of fate, how closely bound was his own destiny with that of Keats. How soon he, too, would fall defeated in the eternal war of poetry and fact. For Shelley, as Sir Henry Maine would have put it, had based his life and thought on the state of nature, on Rousseau's dream of a golden age in which all men had been or would be equal, and he was almost physiologically hostile to that historical method which balances ideals with realities and aspirations with history. He could not read history. It seemed to him an abominable record of miseries and crimes. In every age that he studied, he sought out not the actual conduct and vicissitudes of men, but their poetry and their religion, their ideal feelings and desires. He knew Aeschylus better than he knew Thucydides, and he forgot that in Aeschylus, Prometheus was bound. What could be more certain than his suffering? He was as sensitive as his sensitive plant, subject like it to quick decay, while rougher fibers flourished and survived. He described himself through Julian as, quote, "me, who am as a nerve o'er which do creep the else unfelt oppressions of this earth," close quote. No one would have thought, seeing this delicate lad, never quite adult, that he had set all England fuming with his heresies. Trelawney, meeting him for the first time, wrote, quote, "Was it possible this mild-looking, beardless boy could be the veritable monster at war with all the world?" close quote. MacReady, the painter, said that he could not portray Shelley's face because it was, quote, "too beautiful," close quote, and too elusively so. The man's soul was elsewhere. No one was ever more completely or exclusively a poet. He is to poets what Spenser was before Shelley came, the very embodiment of all that poetry means. Poetry, he wrote in his famous defense, poetry and the principle of self, of which money is the visible incarnation, are the god and the mammon of the world. But it exceeds all imagination to conceive what would have been the moral condition of the world if neither Dante, Petrarch, Boccaccio, Chaucer, Shakespeare, Calderon, Lord Bacon, nor Milton had ever existed, if Raphael and Michelangelo had never been born, if the Hebrew poetry had never been translated, if a revival of the study of Greek literature had never taken place, if no monuments of ancient sculpture had been handed down to us, and if the poetry of the religion of the ancient world had been extinguished together with its beliefs. Close quote. On July 8, 1822, Shelley and his friend Williams left the Casa Magni, in which they were staying on the island of Lerici, and sailed in Shelley's boat, the Ariel, across the Bay of Spezia to Leghorn, to meet the impoverished Leigh Hunt and his abounding family, whom Shelley had recklessly invited to Italy as his guests. The little sailboat accomplished the trip to Leghorn safely, but as they were all about to return, the skies announced a storm. Hunt decided to remain behind with his brood, and to come the next day, but Shelley insisted on returning to Lerici. Mary Shelley and Mrs. Williams had been left there alone, and would be worried if their men did not appear. As the two youths set out from the harbor, the sailors on the ships they passed warned them to come back, but they sailed on. When they failed to reach Casa Magni that night, Mary Shelley knew that fate had taken her poet from her. She broke out in wild despair and engaged a vessel early the next morning to take her to Leghorn. There she found Hunt and Byron, but no Williams or Shelley. Byron went energetically to work and had the coast searched for mile after mile. It was not till after 8 days that they found the body of Williams, lying bloated and almost unrecognizable on the sands. And not for another 2 days did they find Shelley, all that remained of him. The flesh torn away from his bones by vultures, the face gone beyond recognition. They knew him only from the Sophocles in one pocket and the Keats in another. The law of Tuscany required that bodies thrown up by the sea must be burnt to avoid pestilence. So Byron and Hunt and Trelawney built a pyre. And when the body was half consumed, Trelawney snatched the heart out of the flames. The widow had the heart buried near Keats in the Protestant cemetery at Rome, under a slab bearing the simple words, Cor Cordium, Heart of Hearts. When she died 29 years later, it was found that her copy of Adonais contained, in a silken covering, the ashes of her dead lover, at that page which speaks of immortality and the hope that springs forever in defeated men. Number 10. Walt Whitman. Come, muse, migrate from Greece and Ionia. Cross out, please, those immensely overpaid accounts. That matter of Troy and Achilles' wrath, and Aeneas, Odysseus' wanderings. Placard removed and to let on the rocks of your snowy Parnassus. Repeat at Jerusalem, place the notice high on Jaffa's Gate and on Mount Moriah. The same on the walls of your Gothic European cathedrals and German, French, and Spanish castles. For no a better, fresher, busier sphere, a wide, untried domain awaits, demands you. I heard that you asked for something to prove this puzzle, the New World, and to define America, her athletic democracy. Therefore I send you my poems, that you behold in them what you wanted. It was a great revolution in the history of literature when a man appeared who saw the elements of poetry, the scenes of human drama, in the very life about him, who found a way to put into song the spirit of the pioneer, and who saw that there was more poetry out under the stars than in all the salons of an unnatural life. Almost for the first time, a poet was to find themes worthy of noble verse in the lives of common men. He would lift the people up into literature and be a declaration of independence and the rights of man in poetry. He would incarnate not some dead ideal of Arthur or some forgotten myth of forgotten gods, but his own rough country, his own dubious democracy, his own turbulent and growing time. What Homer had been to Greece, Virgil to Rome, Dante to Italy, Shakespeare to England, he was to be for America, because he dared to see in her, with all her faults, her material of song. He made for her new life a new form of verse, as loose and irregular, as flowing and strong as himself. And so truly did he see and sing that at last he became not only the poet of democracy and America, but, by the greatness of his soul and the universality of his vision, the poet of the modern world. The originality of Leaves of Grass, says a French critic, is perhaps the most absolute which has ever been manifest in literature. Originality first in words. Here are no delicate nuances of language, no Shelleyan cloudiness of metaphysical speech, but masculine adjectives and nouns, plain, blunt words, daringly raised from the streets and the fields to poetry. Quote, "I had great trouble in leaving out the stock poetical touches, but succeeded at last." Close quote. And then originality of form. No rhymes except in occasional failures like Captain My Captain, and no regular meter or rhythm, but only such free and varying rhythms as breathing might show, or the wind, or the sea. Above all, originality of matter, the simple approach of an admiring child to the old and unhackneyed wonders of nature, quote, the noiseless splash of the sunrise, close quote, quote, the mad pushes of waves upon the land, close quote, the vivid identification of himself with every soul in every experience, quote, my voice is the wife's voice, the screech by the rail of the stairs, they fetch my man's body up, dripping and drowned, close quote. The brave sincerity of an open mind, rejecting and loving all creeds, the frank and lusty sense of the flesh, the tang and fragrance of the open road, the defense and understanding of woman. The old face of the mother of many children. Whist, I am fully content. Behold, a woman. She looks out from her Quaker cap. Her face is clearer and more beautiful than the sky. She sits in an armchair under the shaded porch of the farmhouse. The sun just shines on her old white head. Her ample gown is of cream-hued linen. Her grandsons raise the flax, and her granddaughters spun it with the distaff and the wheel. The melodious character of the earth, the finish beyond which philosophy cannot go, and does not wish to go, the justified mother of men. The profound synthesis of individualism and democracy, the cosmic sweep of his imagination and his sympathy, accepting all peoples and saluting the world, these were vivifying shocks to all traditions, all prejudices, all spirits caught in ancient grooves and molds, and the very protests they aroused proved their power and their necessity. All America denounced him, except one man, who redeemed them with a letter that is the seal of his nobility. On July 21, 1855, Emerson wrote to Whitman, "Dear Sir, I am not blind to the worth of the wonderful gift of Leaves of Grass. I find in it the most extraordinary piece of wit and wisdom America has yet contributed. I am very happy in reading it, as great power makes us happy. I give you joy of your free and brave thought. I greet you at the beginning of a great career, which yet must have had a long foreground somewhere for such a start. I rubbed my eyes a little to see if this sunbeam were no illusion, for the solid sense of the book is a sober certainty. I wish to see my benefactor, and have felt very much like striking my tasks and visiting New York to pay you my respects." R. W. Emerson. Whitman is gone, but how lately? He lived when we were children. Even in our time, then, there can be giants, and even America, so crass and young, can produce a poet unique and among the best. Some months ago, I stood in his Camden home, where paralysis kept him an invalid for many years, and I mourned to see about me all these reminders that genius, too, must die. But then I took up his book and read once more the lines that have always haunted me, lines that are here left as the parting word to haunt other memories endlessly. I depart as air. I shake my white locks at the runaway sun. I effuse my flesh in eddies and drift it in lacy jags. I bequeath myself to the dirt to grow from the grass I love. If you want me again, look for me under your boot soles. You will hardly know who I am or what I mean. But I shall be good health to you nevertheless, and filter and fiber your blood. Failing to fetch me at first, keep encouraged. Missing me one place, search another. I stop somewhere, waiting for you. Chapter 4. The 100 Best Books for an Education. If I were rich, I would have many books, and I would pamper myself with bindings bright to the eye and soft to the touch, paper generously opaque, and type such as men designed when printing was very young. I would dress my gods in leather and gold, and burn candles of worship before them at night, and string their names like beads on a rosary. I would have my library spacious and dark and cool, safe from alien sights and sounds, with slender casements opening on quiet fields, voluptuous chairs inviting communion and reverie, shaded lamps illuminating sanctuaries here and there, and every inch of the walls concealed with the mental heritage of our race. And there, at any hour, my hand or spirit would welcome my friends, if their souls were hungry and their hands were clean. In the center of that temple of my books, I would gather the 100 best of all the educative literature in the world. I picture to myself a massive redwood table worked out in loving detail by the artist who carved the wood for King Henry's Chapel at Westminster Abbey. I must be an old reactionary, for I abominate the hard materials that make our concrete homes and iron beds and desks today. And I find something organically responsive to my affection in everything made of wood. Along the center of the table would stand a glass case, protecting and yet revealing my 100 best. I picture my friends treated comfortably there, occasional hours of every week passing from volume to volume with loving leisureliness. Will you sit down with me? Perhaps you are a college graduate and are ready, then, to begin your education. Perhaps you have never had a chance to go to college and have never considered what else our children learn there except the latest morals. They might learn many fine things if they came to it old enough, but our youngsters take so long to grow up in these complex days that they are too immature when they enter college to absorb or understand the treasures offered them there so lavishly. If you have studied with life rather than with courses, it may be as well. The rough tutelage of reality has ripened you into some readiness to know great men. Here at this spacious table, you will prepare yourself for membership in the International of the Mind. You will be friends with Plato and Leonardo, with Bacon and Montaigne. And when you have passed through that goodly company, you will be fit for the fellowship of the finest leaders of your time and place. Can you spare an hour a day? Or if some days are too crowded with life and duty to give you leisure for these subtler things, can you atone for such bookless evenings by an extra hour or two on those Sunday mornings when the endless newspaper consumes you to no end? Let me have 7 hours a week, and I will make a scholar and a philosopher out of you. In 4 years, you will be as well educated as any new-fledged doctor of philosophy in the land. But let us understand each other. You must not expect any material gain from this intimacy with great men. Some lucre may flow incidentally in later years from the maturity and background you will win, but these dividends, like those of the insurance companies, are not in any way guaranteed. Indeed, you will be losing time from your profession or your business. If you long for millions, you had better lay aside this map of the city of God and keep your nose to the earth. And there will be blocks along the line. Occasionally, you will come to an obscure or lengthy book, a bad upgrade, and all your strength will have to be subpoenaed to your task. Remember that we are not making a list of the absolutely best 100 books. No list merely of the masterpieces of belles lettres. We are choosing those volumes that will do most to make a man educated. Since we wish to have orderly minds and to avoid the chaos of desultory reading, we shall want to begin at the beginning, even with the distant stars and the antique earth, and these beginnings will be the worst obstructions in our path. Initium dimidium facti, said the Romans, the start is half the deed. Let us gird up our loins and screw our courage to the sticking point for these initial hills, and the rest will be level road, with knowledge and wisdom at every milestone and pleasant reaches of beauty everywhere. We want here not entertainment only, but education, and we want it in such order that the knowledge we win may fall into logical sequence in our memories, and give us at last that full perspective which is the source and summit of understanding. Therefore, the first books on our list, the necessary introduction to the rest, are the most terrifying of all. 1,000 barbs of wit will be invited by placing the outline of science first. Alas, are we to be fed on predigested food in the fashion of an American breakfast? Worse still, the outline of history, bugbear of all proper historians, is fifth on our list. This is unforgivable. Let the critic control himself. He will soon see how far these books are used as substitutes, and how far is preparation for the best. At the cost of a little unpleasantness, we must make ourselves acquainted with the current scientific description of the world in which man has grown. We must have a little astronomical and biological background to give some modesty to our conception of the human race. We must learn the latest gossip about electrons and chromosomes, and look for a moment while physics and chemistry transform the world. And then, still as introductory, we pass to ourselves. It will not do to leave for the last some knowledge of the art of health. What if, after 4 years, we are learned in dyspeptic, philosophers in imagination, and ruins in the flesh? Let two great physicians offer us their rival theories of how to live. Dr. Clendening will tell us, with wit scandalous in a scientist, that most of the things we eat, drink, smoke, or do are well and good. And Dr. Kellogg, with no other charm than 70 years of experience and his own ruddy health, will tell us that these ancient ways are all wrong. I believe that Dr. Kellogg is usually right, but it's conceivable that both of us are usually wrong. We have minds as well as bodies, and perhaps we should try in some measure to understand ourselves before we ponder the history of mankind. Go then to William James. It is true that he wrote more than a generation ago, but his Principles of Psychology is still the masterpiece in its field. Avoid the abbreviated edition in one volume. The longer form is easier to read. Until you have surrounded James, you need not bother with such transitory psychological fashions as psychoanalysis and behaviorism. And when you have absorbed James, you will be immune to these epidemics. Read actively, not passively. Consider at every step whether what you read accords with your own experience, and how far it may be applied to the guidance of your own life. But if you disagree with an author, or are shocked by his heresies, read on nevertheless. Toleration of differences is one mark of a gentleman. Make notes of all passages that offer help toward the reconstruction of your character, not someone else's character, or the achievement of your aims, and classify these notes in such a way that they may at any moment, and for any purpose, be ready to your hand. Take your time with these introductory books, for you must expect a long siege before you capture these obscure and lofty outworks of wisdom's citadel. If they burden your digestion, spice them with easier morsels from the list, Plutarch, for example, or Omar, or George Moore, or Rabelais, or Poe, numbers 16, 31, 32, 45, and 91. Indeed, most of the books in groups 10 and 11 will serve as hors d'oeuvres or relief when other volumes oppress you with their heaviness. Even Wells will prove a little dull at the outset. We grow a trifle weary of his reptiles and fishes, his Cro-Magnon and Neanderthal men. But we must climb up these geological periods, and wade through these paleontological remains and anthropological origins. We sharpen our teeth on these forbidding words, we take these difficulties by the bit, and harden ourselves for anything. If we are prosperous as well as brave, we shall buy a handy dictionary, such as Webster's Collegiate. Avoid vast dictionaries whose size discourage their use. And we shall adorn a wall with some spacious map of the world, so that new words and old places shall have some meaning for us. Once those Wellsian chapters are finished, Sumner's Folkways will be enticing dessert. No one had dreamed that a professor could make sociology so fascinating. Do you want to know how religion began and how it grew up from superstition to philosophy? Read Fraser's Golden Bough. Here a great scholar has brought together in one volume the lifelong researches for which the British government, honoring itself, made him a knight of the realm. Skip, if you will, learn the art of seizing out of every paragraph, usually near its beginning, the topical sentence in which the author lays down the proposition which his paragraph hopes to prove. And if this thesis falls outside your use or interest, leap on to the next topic, or the next, until you feel that the author is talking to you. Once that knighted volume is finished, the heaviest part of your education is over. The rest will be an adventure with gods. Why is our list henceforth historically arranged? First, because it is well to study history as it was lived and made, taking all the activities of a civilization together, economic, social, political, scientific, philosophical, religious, literary, and artistic. In this way, we shall see every work of literature, philosophy, or art in its proper place, and better understand its origin and significance. Perspective is all. Second, because this arrangement will let the most delightful and entertaining masterpieces alternate with ponderous, instructive tomes. It will be an aid to digestion. So after a little more of Wells and Breasted's perfect chapter on Egypt in that excellent history of Europe, The Human Adventure, we shall find welcome diversion in Brian Brown's selection of bits of wisdom from Confucius, Lao Tzu, and Mencius. And the unequaled simplicity and beauty of the Bible will atone for Fors' dithyrambs on art and Dr. Williams' meaty History of Science. If you cannot secure this rare and excellent work, use Dampier Wetman's History of Science, or Ginsberg's The Adventure of Science. By these rough seas, we come at last to the Isles of Greece. Here is genius almost too abundant. How shall we crowd so many giants into our little list? Let us engage guides. Breasted and Wells will show us the larger monuments, Professor Bury will unravel for us the complexities of Greek politics, and Gilbert Murray will introduce us to the greatest literature ever written. And then the geniuses themselves, Herodotus with his delightful stories, not always true, Thucydides with his realistic thinking and his classic style. The famous funeral oration composed for Pericles by Thucydides is in Book 11, Chapter 6. Plutarch with biographies that will make the names in Bury live on the stage of our memories. Homer with his lilting song of gods and heroes, of Helen and Penelope. Aeschylus the Mighty with his picture of Prometheus chained and unrepentant, the very symbol of genius punished for advancing the race. Sophocles with a gentle wisdom won from suffering, and Euripides the Human, mourning the misfortunes of his enemies and at last forgiving even the gods. Here is the first and greatest period in European philosophy. Diogenes Laertius tells the story of Socrates the Martyr and Plato the Reformer, of Democritus the Laughing Philosopher, and Aristotle the Encyclopedia, of Zeno the Stoic, an Epicurus who was not an Epicurean. Plato speaks and paints his perfect state. The immaculately reasonable Aristotle preaches the golden mean and marries the richest girl in Greece. Williams takes up the tale and tells how science replaced superstition, how Hippocrates became, after many centuries of physicians, the father of medicine, and how Archimedes solved his theorems while a soldier, symbolizing the eternal opposition of war and art, stabbed him to death. Last of all, Ily IV lets us stand by while Phidias, with the patience that is genius, carves figures for the Parthenon, and Praxiteles chisels Aphrodite's perfect grace. When shall we see such an age again?